This is WCSX Online. Our live web stream begins in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
Longer enough. In an era when traditional political institutions seem largely paralyzed and the problems we face are converging from all sides, information must serve as the basis for actions each and all of us can take. How might all this new media be harnessed to help us collectively generate new approaches to our most urgent challenges? With this question in mind, we turn now to cyberspace futurists David Weinberger and Ethan Zuckerman, both fellows at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. David joins us from the Harvard News Office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Ethan from his home in Western Massachusetts.
David, essentially the one-to-many lectures that the media have been up to now in some ways, it's sort of unidirectional. It comes from the producer towards the audience. It being transformed into conversations, into essentially public conversations, what you say is that these conversations, people don't get how subversive it is to take institutions and turn them into conversations. Tell me about that, how you turn institutions into conversations.
You go on the web. Although it looks to the previous culture like a series of small broadcasts, a series of small op-eds, that's how blogs were initially understood by the media, that as everybody's a columnist now. What in fact I think is going on, a better working metaphor at least to begin with, is that this is a conversation, that weblogs respond to other weblogs. They respond to comments. We're building this linked web. I mean, links are obviously at the heart of the web, just architecturally. And we are rapidly building this mass of ideas linked to other ideas back and forth. And that's a type of conversation. Now, some parts of the web are more obviously conversational than others, and chat rooms are highly conversational in a traditional sense. Weblogs are like a much slower conversation, but the point is that no one person gets to pronounce and gather the authority that the privilege of pronouncing takes for itself. I'll give you just a quick example. Wikipedia stands in contrast in many ways to traditional encyclopedias, Wikipedia being the bottom-up encyclopedia that anybody can edit. Well, if you're an expert in some topic, the world's leading expert, you might have the microphone in the broadcast regime, and so you get to pronounce, and now we all know what to believe because you're the expert that we hear, and we probably are well served to believe that. I'm assuming you truly are an expert. If, however, you go onto Wikipedia as the world's leading expert on some topic, and you decide you're going to write the article, and somebody has the temerity to edit your words, and you refuse to engage in the conversation at Wikipedia, because there's a discussion that goes on that explains, here's why I edited it, here's why you should change it back, here's a compromise. If you're unwilling to engage in that, then you simply have to withdraw from Wikipedia. You have no place in it. Your edits will be overwritten. So I actually think that this is a good step forward for knowledge. Rather than thinking that knowledge and authority belongs to the world-class expert who gets the microphone, we are instead saying, with, I think, a great deal of truth, that even the ideas of the world's greatest expert are improved when they are put into conversation with others, people who have a different point of view, who raise issues that the individual might not see. That knowledge is only improved. And so the knowledge now becomes that which we argue about in public, that which we talk about in public. It's never finished. It's never done. It's never resolved. No one person owns it. It's better for being shared among us.
Ethan, picking up on David's point about a sort of ever-evolving experimental kind of conversation, can this kind of capability be harnessed in ways so that the conversation can be aimed at actually solving human problems and resolving human conflicts?
Certainly at best, that's where the conversation goes. And I think we've seen some intriguing hints that those conversations are possible and that people are interested in having them. One of the recent conversations that I've been most interested in, I guess it's now almost a year old, was a conversation about last year's Live 8 concert. Live 8! So this was Bob Geldof's concerts to raise awareness of issues in Africa.
A child dies completely unnecessarily as a result of extreme poverty every 3 seconds.
And it became a very interesting topic in the blogosphere, mostly because Technorati, David Sifri's company, decided to pay a great deal of attention to it and started inviting people to tag their blog posts Live Aid. And so what happened was, predictably, a lot of American and European bloggers started talking about how exciting it was, and we'll get to see Madonna on stage, and, you know, what will you two sing? At the same time, a whole bunch of African bloggers started writing about how offensive and farcical they found the whole event to be, and also started using the Live Aid tag. And so what this meant was, you would go to Technorati, you would look at the Live Aid conversation, and at the beginning of it, you had music fans talking about music, and Africans and Africanists talking about politics, and sort of talking past one another. But as David mentioned, this medium is all about conversation, and so you suddenly had these really intriguing dialogues where people who had initially said something like, wait, we're just trying to help you poor Africans, would find themselves in sort of long, detailed dialogue with a Tanzanian economist who was making the argument that this sort of aid-dependent mentality is, in fact, what's hurting Africa. So this is a conversation that doesn't happen very often in the real world, but it's a conversation that was profoundly enlightening, certainly for the music fans who weren't thinking very deeply about the social issue associated with all of this. I also think it was pretty enlightening for some of the African bloggers to get a sense for what people did and didn't know about events on the ground. Because a lot of what we're finding with bloggers from the developing world is that they're using this medium to try to help people understand what they're actually facing in daily life. At best, I've seen these conversations become a space for organizing. And one of the most interesting ones comes out of the Indian blogosphere. Indian bloggers reacted amazingly quickly to the Southeast Asia tsunami. And these guys coordinated an enormous amount of information and relief efforts within Southeast Asia, took in news reports, linked it together, put up databases of information, ran a news service, pointed people towards emergency phone numbers. They got so good at doing this that when the Katrina hurricanes hit, a lot of the folks actually got involved with organizing some of the information around Katrina. There was a wonderful period of time for about a week where if you called an 800 number from the United States looking for Katrina hurricane assistance, you would talk to Dina Mehta in Mumbai, who was online something like 24/7 that week, helping you find hurricane information, helping you find your family and friends. So that's the sort of thing that can come out of these conversations, are amazing organizing efforts, as well as conversations that change opinion.
I'm still drawn to the difference between, you know, contributing your opinion and contributing your solution. I think they're two very different things, and debate and collaboration are two very different things, aren't they? David, what I'm trying to get at is really reorienting not only the way we use the internet, but the way we use information. Do we use information simply to accumulate it for better understanding, or do we use it to solve human problems? And if we use it to solve human problems, are there ways in which new media can be used for the very best minds to come together worldwide and collaborate in real time in ways they never have before?
Yes.
Good. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
The internet, when it started out in the U.S., was referred to as the information highway, you know, early on because of its origins. But it's hard to explain the ardor with which it's been taken up so quickly by that first billion, simply by thinking of it as a pathway to information. I mean, when did a billion people ever become so wildly, madly enthusiastic about doing research, about getting information? I mean, so that's one of the things you do on the internet, but the internet is, from my point of view, is a connective medium. It connects people in the way that space does in the real world, and we do basically the same sorts of things in the internet space. So yes, we inform ourselves, and yes, we debate, and yes, we collaborate, and yes, we swear at each other, and yes, we fall in love, and yes, we listen to music. What is it that we don't do on the internet. I think it's really important to view the informational aspect of the internet as one, it's an important thing that it does, but just one thing that it does.
I wonder whether there are ways in which the creativity that's so much at the heart of the human personality when it's liberated can be facilitated by these new technologies to become what I call social creativity, which is again the notion that you're using creativity and innovation specifically to solve problems that if we don't solve these problems, we won't have a life worth living together.
I think some of it is happening online. Certainly on issues that I'm interested in and I follow, there are people proposing solutions, and then there are other people going and critiquing those solutions and working through them together. There are people using their blog to brainstorm, and then they're working usually with a fairly small group of people to work those ideas out a little bit further. If we accept that what the internet really does is sort of gives us this opportunity to share a common space, we should start thinking about, you know, other very busy, very crowded common spaces that we encounter in real life. If I walk into a party, I'm quickly going to gravitate to the people that I already know, or I might gravitate to the people who are talking about or thinking about the issues that I already have an opinion on or that I'm already discussing. The second part of this is that we often don't know what we are interested in. We go out looking in the search paradigm for things that we think are going to be interesting to us, and we end up perhaps missing lots of what else is out there. Our colleague Dan Gilmore has a wonderful phrase that he thinks may be very necessary in the internet age, which is institutionalized serendipity. If you think about a newspaper, daily newspaper, the bottom left corner almost always has a story that is intended to make you think about something you might not think you're interested in. It's a little off the beaten track. It's maybe not something that you expected to pay attention to, but the editor puts it there so that you can have a bit of serendipity and the chance of sort of encountering something else. We need to figure out how to bring more serendipity into the online space to make it more likely that people end up engaging with topics that they didn't think they wanted to engage with.
Cyberspace pioneers David Weinberger and Ethan Zuckerman. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Streaming audio from your classic rock home in cyberspace. 94.7 WCSX.
I shot Sherry.
Yes. WCSX Classic Rock Webstream.
WCSX looking at your weather forecast this Sunday morning. Staff meteorologist Jim Addison today calling for, well, mostly sunny skies, high getting up to 48, breezy and windy at times. Wind gusts up to 22 miles an hour. Clear tonight, low dropping to 39. Mostly sunny on Monday. High will get up to near 62. Cloudy on Monday night, low dropping to 53. And just because Halloween's right around the corner, we'll take a look at Tuesday real fast. Probably cloudy, going to top out at a high near 60. Making it for a mild night on Tuesday night for the trick-or-treaters. So always kind of gauging that one. Obviously, you know, it's going to snow and we got fall upon us. But hey, with Tuesday upon us, Halloween, definitely a good night to get out there and enjoy it. Clear right now. It's pleasant 38. Back to the counterspin program in just a moment. Then we go to the Peter Werby program right after that. Sunday morning over easy at 7 o'clock. But we jump to counterspin right after these.
Digital audio on your desktop.
Computers can do that?
The Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, when a study in the British medical journal The Lancet found that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died as a consequence of the war, the research was dismissed by George W. Bush, who called its methodology flawed. U.S. media outlets also cast doubt, calling the peer-reviewed findings disputed and pointing to lower estimates as more reliable. Daniel Davies, a writer for the Comment is Free blog on the website of London's newspaper The Guardian, will join us to explain why the critics are wrong. Also on the show, the FCC's war on what they call indecency has led to a tenfold increase in fines levied to stations. A new report outlines how that, combined with a high degree of uncertainty about just what might be judged indecent next, is already leading to a chilling risk avoidance among creative artists. But we'll hear from veteran children's programming advocate Peggy Charon about the effect censorship has on the kids it's supposed to be protecting. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
On October 17th, the New York Times published an almost literal love letter to Dick Cheney. The headline, "Cheney Feels the Love as He Hits the Heartland," accurately summed up the tone of the piece. The article celebrated Cheney's visit to what the paper called Cheney Country, quote, hotel ballrooms, military bases, and private homes deep in the reddest of red states like Kansas, where President Bush and Mr. Cheney won by 25 percentage points in 2004. As a rule, people still love Mr. Bush in Cheney Country, at least relative to some locales, close quote. As the careful reader will suspect, it's that last phrase that's the tricky spot. Because if the paper is actually purporting to be writing about the White House's popularity as a meaningful political phenomenon, it has to be significant that according to a recent poll, 51% of Kansans, a majority, disapprove of Bush's job performance. Granted, 51% disapproval is pretty popular relative to some locales, like, say, Vermont, where Bush meets with 71% disapproval. Still, it's hard not to think the Times might have served its readers better by explaining why Bush is having trouble in the reddest of red states, rather than focusing, as this article did, on a six-year-old with a crush on Dick Cheney's dogs.
More in that vein, on October 12th, Howard Kurtz, staff writer for the Washington Post, wrote a fairly glowing column about Tony Snow's able-bodied work as White House press secretary. Although he noted at one point that, quote, away from the cameras, journalists give Snow mixed grades for providing information, close quote, the column's overriding theme is that Snow is considered an asset to the administration for bringing, in Kurtz's terms, a flashy Fox News sensibility to the high-profile podium, and due to an affability that has allowed him to smooth over any rough interactions with the press corps. All else aside, it seems a little odd for Snow to get such a rave when the approval ratings for the person he's a spokesperson for, after all, are hovering between 33% and 39%. But in addition to introducing entertainment values to the briefing room, Tony Snow has also begun to help raise cash for the Republican Party, a fact which raises no serious red flags from Kurtz, despite his acknowledgement that no other press secretary has done the same, because it's traditionally believed that, quote, the public face of an administration should not moonlight as a partisan operative, close quote. But what difference does that make if he's so likable, right?
Concerned about the announcement that North Korea has the bomb, Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer says he has the solution. On October 17th, Krauthammer wrote that the United States should simply declare that any nuclear detonation against the U.S. or its allies will be considered an attack by North Korea on the U.S., quote, requiring a full retaliatory response upon North Korea, close quote. In other words, Krauthammer explains, the government has to make Kim Jong-il, quote, understand that his survival would be hostage to the actions of whatever terrorist group he sold his weapons to. Any terrorist detonation would be assumed to have his address on it. The United States would then return postage. Automaticity of this kind concentrates the mind, close quote. If this solution sounds familiar to Counterspin listeners, it's because Krauthammer has taken a page from Ted Koppel's book. As we noted recently, Koppel's solution to Iran's nuclear progress, which he presented in a September 26 New York Times op-ed, was to adopt a state policy that upon any dirty bomb explosions in Middle America or against our Middle East allies, quote, the return address will be predetermined and it will be somewhere in Iran, close quote. Krauthammer, perhaps having read Koppel's column, acknowledges that his plan, quote, works only in a world where there is but a single rogue nuclear state, which is another reason why keeping Iran from going nuclear is so important, close quote. Of course, we already live in a world where Pakistan has been caught marketing its nuclear technology, and where Russia's control over its stockpile of surplus atomic weaponry has long been questioned. In a world where 44 nations have nuclear reactors, surely there are other potential sources for terrorists seeking fissionable materials. So, like Koppel's, Krauthammer's solution makes little sense in terms of deterrence. Perhaps Krauthammer ought to work on concentrating his own mind before tackling Kim Jong-il's.
As dismissibly outrageous or silly as we may find the pronouncements of some pundits, we have to remember that these people are in the living rooms, so to speak, of millions of people. And by having a prominent role in mainstream conversation, their ideas, even if they aren't shared, are still on some level legitimized. Which is why it's worth taking note of an evident uptick in disturbing, if not exactly original, rhetoric about identifying domestic enemies. As David Neuert noted recently on the blog Orsinus, cable TV favorite Dinesh D'Souza's new book, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11, is being released not by some small conservative imprint, but by Doubleday. D'Souza's themes about how the likes of Hillary Clinton and Michael Moore represent an enemy to be defeated in order to protect ourselves from terrorism are heard also from Michael Barone of U.S. News and World Report, who has written recently about covert enemies who, quote, live in large numbers in our midst, close quote, and who, quote, have propagated their ideas through the universities, the schools, and mainstream media, close quote. The notion also provides the theme for Fox's Bill O'Reilly's new book, Culture Warrior, in which he declares, quote, war is exactly the right term. On one side of the battlefield are the armies of the traditionalists like me. On the other side are the committed forces of the secular progressive movement, close quote. Attempts to turn dissenters into traitors are nothing new, of course, but at a time when Congress has passed a bill that would allow the administration to unilaterally declare any citizen an unlawful enemy combatant, this media militarization of political disagreements can only be seen as a frightening development.
And finally, media illiteracy is rampant in the U.S., and now it seems to have reached the top echelons of network newsrooms. What else could explain Charles Gibson's remarks to the Philadelphia Inquirer when the ABC World News anchor told the paper that evening newscasts had too many commercials for old people? Gibson explained that if the networks were serious about attracting young viewers, they should replace commercials for adult diapers, dentures, and pills with spots for younger, sexier products. Quote, I'd rather have car ads. When you put on ads mostly for medicines, you're saying, we want an older audience, close quote. Gibson apparently doesn't know how commercial television, the industry he's been working in for decades, works. Because in television, you don't pick and choose commercials based on the audience you wish you had. Advertisers sponsor your programs based on the people who actually watch your shows. Once a sort of open secret, we thought the business underpinnings of journalism were at this point pretty well understood. Guess not.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
When the prestigious British medical journal The Lancet published a peer-reviewed study of Iraq war fatalities that found that perhaps 600,000 excess deaths have occurred in Iraq as a consequence of the war, it created an immediate controversy. On one side, defenders explained that the study used the same tried-and-true statistical methods used to gauge excess deaths in other wars, disasters, and epidemics. On the other, some doubters wondered how one could extrapolate such large numbers from such small ones. But most avoided statistical arguments in favor of political ones, charging the study's authors and promoters with political bias. Daniel Davies is a contributor to the Comment is Free blog on the British newspaper The Guardian's website, where he published the commentary The Numbers Do Add Up on October 12th. Daniel Davies, welcome to Counterspin.
Hi, Steve.
Daniel, you say as a matter of statistics that the numbers are not hard to understand, but their presentation is sometimes not all it could be. For instance, you say that people should not concentrate so much on the number 655,000 that's been reported. Explain that for us.
Sure. If you've got a number like 650K there, then it looks on the face of it like it counts. You know, it's more or less impossible presentationally to get away from the fact that that number, sort of with kind of a comma in the middle, looks like the result of a census, and it's not and could not be, you know, remotely comparable to a kind of census estimate. Also, it's an excess figure. So you're actually measuring it against a counterfactual baseline, the baseline of what would have happened if the treatment, in this case the invasion of Iraq, had never happened. You know, it's not disreputable, it's not a wrong way to kind of do treatment analysis, because that's the only way you can do it, but it does mean that that actual number is not something that I would want anyone to kind of bet anything important on. On the other hand, what that number is a way of describing kind of the results that you got, and the key result that you get here is that if you survey 12,000 individuals in 47 clusters of 40 households each, and you get the result that something like 300 people in that sample have died, that is not remotely consistent with there being zero excess deaths. It's not consistent with there being 50,000 excess deaths. It's probably not even consistent with there being a number less than 200,000 excess deaths. The number 650,000 is the hypothesis where it's kind of even money whether it was higher or lower than that.
So we're still talking about, at minimum, hundreds of thousands of deaths.
No, absolutely. I simply don't see how anyone could possibly defend a number less than 100,000 or 200,000 on the basis of all the evidence that we've got. I mean, in particular, if you look at some of the numbers, well, the Iraq body count high estimates or the extrapolations from the Baghdad morgue data of 40, 50, 60,000 deaths, then that would imply a death rate in Iraq at present, which would be roughly equal to 1972 in Northern Ireland, which was the worst year of the Troubles, or indeed roughly equal to last year in Jamaica in terms of murders, or you know, a particularly bad year in an American urban center in a crack war. Those are obviously bad places to live. I personally would not choose to live in any one of them, but it's clear, just simply from the non-data information, that you know, human life was kind of going on in Northern Ireland and in Jamaica or whatever in a way that it's not going on in a normal way in Iraq at present. You know, it's just not credible for someone to say that things there are no worse than they were last year in Jamaica.
Regarding the doubters, you point out that if one has faith in the political polls routinely reported in the news, then they shouldn't disparage the Lancet's findings. What do you mean by that?
It's the same sort of methodology. I mean, in particular, there is a surprisingly large community of people who have made the decision to sit down at a computer and write an article and publish it on the internet or in a newspaper who clearly don't know what they're talking about. You can't put it any less bluntly than that. If someone is saying that it is intrinsically impossible to extrapolate 547 total deaths, 300 violent deaths, to a number of 650,000 total excess deaths, then it's not just kind of questioning a technical aspect of this study. That critique is implicitly going to the absolute heart of saying that they just simply don't believe in random sampling as a method of learning things about the world. It's the mere random sample critique, which has been around for as long as statistics, or specifically it's been around as long as ignorance about statistics.
There's been a significant backlash against the Lancet study. The Associated Press here in the United States contrasted the Lancet's findings with what they called a respected group whose estimate was closer to 50,000. Can you comment about the backlash?
There's sort of slight attribution issue here, in that everyone, including me, calls it the Lancet study, and the ship has sailed for calling it anything else. But it was, in fact, carried out by a team from Johns Hopkins University and a team from the medical school of one of the universities in Baghdad. The Associated Press comparison to, I believe, the respected group that they're talking about is IraqBodyCount.org. Iraq Body Count is a respected group, but they're not respected for making estimates. They don't do estimates. They specifically have a count, and their count is an enumeration of all of the media-reported deaths of civilians in Iraq. There's a lot of what you end up calling denialism on this subject, because there's a lot of people simply deciding in their own minds what would be an acceptable number and then casting around for alternative estimates and nitpicking criticisms of departures from the Platonic form of the perfect survey in order to try and say that they've got some evidence for believing the number that they want to believe. It's probably the case that that's as far as I'd like to get into talking about the reactions to this survey, because as soon as you start talking about it in those terms, you're talking about numbers again, and I really don't like talking about numbers. I like talking about the particular question that we want to answer here, which was this not a disaster, only a little disaster, or a very big disaster? And the answer is, it's certainly a very big disaster, and is decent reason to believe that it could be heading for a disaster of world historic proportions.
Well, one would think that these findings would shock the conscience and should perhaps give pause to those reflexive supporters of the war who respond to criticism by saying, so you think it would be better if Saddam was still in power. Daniel Davies, tell us briefly, why is this study important?
It's important because do you think it would be better is a very subjective and value-laden question, not the sort of thing that anyone could answer. Do you think that more people would be consuming oxygen today if this particular war that was fought in the circumstances it was fought in had not been? And the answer to that appears to be yes, in the hundreds of thousands. It can't possibly be irrelevant to judging the success or failure of something whether or not hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of it. That's something that wouldn't necessarily be the only thing that would enter into the moral calculus, but it's got to be a big part of it. And certainly, and one thing I think does need to be made clear, this is a legitimate field of inquiry for doctors and statisticians working in the field of public health. When you've got this much kind of a movement in the death rate of a very populous country, that's a big problem, and it is exactly the sort of thing that people should be studying.
We have been speaking with Daniel Davies, who writes for the Comment is Free blog for London's Guardian and the Crooked Timber blog site. Daniel Davies, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks very much, Steve.
When the FCC declared war on indecency, there were many who pointed out that the guidelines were too vague and were bound to have a chilling impact on creative artists. But where in the mainstream conversation of this effort justified implicitly or explicitly as a defense of the country's children, did you hear the idea that all of this bleeping out of curse words and levying of fines might not be helping, might indeed be harming the kids it's supposed to be in aid of? Our next guest says just that, and she's not someone easily dismissed as unconcerned with children's interests when it comes to media. She's Peggy Charon, founder in 1968 of Action for Children's Television and a longtime advocate of quality programming for all of us. Welcome to Counterspin, Peggy Charon.
Nice to be here.
Well, the group, the Center for Creative Voices in Media, published a report last month on the impact of the FCC indecency efforts in which you are cited. It gives examples like the one of The Blues, Godfathers and Sons. That was the PBS documentary by Martin Scorsese where swear words of old bluesmen were deemed by the FCC to be indecent. And of course, all of this raises concerns about artist self-censorship. But I was struck by your comment that what effect all of this is going to have on the Martin Scorsese's isn't really the only question that we ought to be asking here, is it?
No, it isn't. I think the censorship has as bad an effect on children as it has on adults. And the nifty thing for parents about stuff they don't want their kids to hear is that they can always use the off button. Now, I know that some parents aren't home, that there are latchkey kids, and the world isn't perfect, but I think that then the obligation for parents is to educate their kids about why they are upset about what they're upset about and why they like what they like. And if you can really do a job talking to your children about how you feel about television, you sort of get between the child and the set, and that's a good thing.
Well, and so you're saying that when we remove content or remove programming, we're actually kind of losing an opportunity then to talk to kids.
Oh, a big opportunity. I think television is one of the best educators we got these days. And parents very often use programming to help their children understand even controversial topics like violence and poverty and racial disparity and cultural diversity. There is a lot of that on television these days, and it's a terrific place to talk to your kids. You know, I don't mean very, very young children, not babies, but as they get older, we have to help them understand how the world works and how we wish it would work better.
Well, one of the points that was made in this report by the Center for Creative Voices and Media was very, very striking. It noted that in 2004, the then head of the FCC's Enforcement Bureau told a group of broadcasters who were looking essentially for guidance on the indecency rules, he told them that he couldn't say whether the 1979 miniseries Roots would be deemed indecent today.
I saw that. And anybody who can't understand that Roots was incredible education, especially for those days, really shouldn't be wrapped up with the Federal Communications Commission. Maybe he should be in the shoe business. But the point about not understanding when a program can educate, even when it's disturbing, is kind of creepy. I mean, I think the whole FCC excitement about dirty words is amazing for any of us, never mind children. You know, the toddlers go through a period of bathroom talk, they call it. Is that what the FCC is going to move in on next? You have the expletives used by soldiers in harrowing stories of war. And when kids get to be certainly young teenagers, that is educational programming, too. And what are you going to have? The soldiers say, goodness gracious, when they go over the edge into a world that's horrifying? I don't know where they're coming from, these characters. And it's very disturbing to me as an old Democrat that it's not only the Republicans on the commission, it's also the Democrats. It seems to be something that hits people when they get to be able to talk about speech. They want to move in and decide what is good and what isn't. It's the opposite of the way we should work in a democracy. You have tough talk that helps define characters in award-winning dramas. If you take away the way they talk, they don't seem like real people. You have Eyes on the Prize, a documentary that enlightens us about history and is something you can use with children. Should the writers be worried about the kind of language that they're going to use when that's the language that's used by people?
Certainly, when media are saying they're more and more concerned about being irrelevant, broadcast media certainly moving further and further away from real life in that regard doesn't seem a way to repair that.
And it isn't only words. They are concerned about TV moments that show images of parts of the body that it associates with sex. You know, everybody seems to be more upset about sex than they are about violence. Sex is sort of nice when you get old enough. Violence is really never very nice. And none of this is designed to limit the amount of violence on television. I'm not saying we should do that, but it's amazing where the FCC is focusing its attention. I think many more parents are concerned about messages to go rub out somebody in the street than they are about somebody who uses a dirty word.
Well, you make the point that parents can, to a large degree, monitor what their children see. But, and we were thinking maybe it was you who we first heard phrase it this way. You can change the dial, but you can't turn on what isn't
right.
there.
Right.
And
absolutely
you,
right.
And you have suggested that maybe all of this is kind of a red herring to distract from a void, a lack of good programming for kids.
I think that what's really missing is programming these days for the older child, for young teenagers, that's designed to educate or to give them some kind of experience that they aren't getting from other kinds of media.
Well, let me ask you finally, as someone, it seems you may have already answered it, but let me ask you finally, as someone who has been monitoring children's programming for some years now, you really haven't seen, it sounds like you're saying, a tremendous change in the amount of really good programming available for young people.
There's more programming. There's a lot more programming because there are channels now that focus on children. But the kind of programming that we used to have with the after-school specials, when the FCC was really concerned about the lack of terrific stuff for kids, where they took the best children's books, prize-winning kids' books, and had the best actors in the country and the best writers and put together our 2-hour programs, that we don't have a lot of anymore. There's a lot of stuff that we're not going to have if we keep this up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Peggy Charon, founder of Action for Children's Television. The report we've been discussing is called Big Chill, How the FCC's Indecency Decisions Stifle Free Expression, Threaten Quality Television, and Harm America's Children. It's by the Center for Creative Voices in Media and can be found on their website, www.creativevoices.us. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin, Peggy Charon.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Audio from your classic rock home in cyberspace. 94.7 WCSX.
Put me in the moon. Storm the walls around this prison. Leave the inmates free, the guards. Deal me up another future from some brand new deck of cards. Take the chip off of my shoulder. Smooth out. Down a canyon, never coming back is clear. Lately I just judge the distance, not the words I hear. I've been too long on these islands. I've been far too long alone. I've been too long without summer in this winter home. Take the time. Maybe we can leave this moment.
you're hearing is the WCSX.com Classic Rock web stream.
Richard Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America, and what a life this guy lived. And there's a brand new biography of him. It's written by John Higgs, and John Higgs has written for British publications including The Guardian, Mojo, and The Independent, and he's created the long-running quiz show X Marks the Spot for BBC Radio 4. He's worked extensively in children's television and animation. He's produced a number of best-selling video games. He lives in Brighton, England. We're talking to him in England right now from Detroit. John Higgs, welcome to the Motor City.
Hi, Peter. Good to speak to you.
Well, thank you so much. Your book is I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. For those few people, or I don't know, maybe we can't count since we have listeners, tell us maybe a little thumbnail sketch of what Timothy Leary is best known for. Of course, your book takes his whole life into consideration, but maybe his most popular media manifestation. What would that look like?
Oh, sure. You know, and certainly in the early 60s, Timothy Leary was a very well-respected psychologist studying at Harvard. And he was researching issues such as behavior change and very well respected for his books and things like that. Then he discovered or was introduced to psychedelic drugs, LSD, became convinced that this was the magic key that would create meaningful character change in people, and made it his life's ambition to persuade as many people as possible to take such drugs. I think we all know what happened next. The phrase tune in, turn on, drop out entered the national sort of lexicon. The hippies movement appeared, music changed forever, and things were never quite the same again.
Right, and Moody Blues had a song about him, incorrectly saying Timothy Leary is dead. No, what is it? What's the line in there? Timothy Leary is dead.
Timothy Leary's dead. Oh, no, he's outside looking in.
Oh, that's right.
But when he died, they re-recorded it so it sings Timothy Leary lives.
And Timothy Leary lived from 1920 to just a little while ago, right?
Yeah, he died 10 years ago. The book was aimed to come out on the 10th anniversary of his death. It's always a good time to reevaluate people around that time, I always think. It's just long enough has gone past to be able to sort of get a clear glimpse at the impact they've had on life and things.
Well, John Higgs, there's been other biographies of Timothy Leary, yet you discovered some new documents. Tell us the story about that. It's a pretty interesting story in itself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was writing for Mojo magazine. I don't know if you get that over here. It's an English classic rock magazine about an album Timothy Leary made with the German krautrock band Astral Temple when he was on the run and hiding in Switzerland. There was an English painter and author called Brian Barrett who was very close to Leary at the time. And I was interviewing him about what had happened. And he just sort of scratched his head and goes, you know, I think I've got some of Tim's things somewhere. And he lives in a council flat in South London, and he just goes over to an old chest of drawers and rifled through it and came out with a few boxes of all Timothy Leary's diaries and letters. And of course, what had happened was Leary was captured in Afghanistan. And brought back to America.
He was he was a fugitive from, escaped from prison. Maybe we can talk about that a little while later. So he was captured in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So he left lots of things behind him for his 2 years on the run around the world. This guy, Brian, had the forethought to sort of gather them up for posterity.